come up on Taiwan.
I'm in the KTAP studios sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sines.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And this is Words on a Wire.
Welcome to another edition.
And this week we have poet Sherwin Bitsui. This young man is just an amazing poet. His book Flood Song is from Copper Canyon, released a couple of years ago, and we're going to talk about that book and his new work.
And it's gotten a lot of attention. This young man is going places.
So stick around. But first, I want to talk a little bit about a project that I'm working on right now, Ben, if I may. You know, Sasha and I are going to Europe this summer. We're going to Rome and then to Tuscany and then spend about 6 weeks or so in Paris and going to Geneva and, you know, places like that. But one of the things that I think you know, I've become an amateur photographer.
I would say that you're more than amateur.
Oh, well, you've been very kind, Ben. But I do photos, and I have a photo blog. It's soychacon.blogspot.com, and it's basically a photo blog where I go around the world or wherever I'm at and take photos, a lot of them from El Paso. But I use an SLR. And everyone knows what a SLR is. It's one of those big cameras, a single lens replacement. I use a Nikon that my partner and best friend, Sasha, got me for my birthday 1 year. And I've been going crazy, right? I've been taking all these pictures. But when you compare an SLR to a point and shoot, it's obvious that an SLR is going to deliver higher quality images. Point and shoot is very limited. Those are those cameras you get at Best Buy, and they come in blue and then white and
like
green.
My little Canon.
Well, obviously, the SLR is going to deliver superior images, but every photographer that I know of carries around a little point-and-shoot as well because you can put it in your pocket. And the fact is, the technology in point-and-shoots today is far superior to what Cartier-Bresson was shooting with 80 years ago, right? And so I have this challenge. We're going to go to Europe. I'm not going to bring my SLR. I'm going to bring a little point-and-shoot. That's it. It's a little Nikon Coolpix 9100. That's all I'm going to bring, and I'm going to see if I can capture professional quality images just with a point-and-shoot. And you know what I'm thinking about it as? I'm thinking about it like a poet. When a poet practices forms, the restriction that comes from that form really allows the poet to go places that perhaps they wouldn't otherwise if they were just doing free writing or just free verse. It kind of develops a discipline. And so my challenge is to bring my point-and-shoot and to try to take images that represent what I see.
It's a photo memoir.
Yeah, but with a point-and-shoot. And so I thought it would be a fun experiment.
It sounds like a great project, Chacon.
Yeah, well, go to my blog. It's soychacon.blogspot.com and read about the challenge. And then throughout the summer, I'll be posting some images on it. It's just something I do for fun. It's like a second art. Sherwin Bitsui is a painter. Ben, you paint amazing images. You have paintings all over your house. You walk in there and it's like a museum. You're just an incredible painter. This is my second art, photography. And I do it for fun.
And no, and it really isn't, though, because you take it seriously, and it may be fun, but I think it also feeds your writing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, my dad was an amateur photographer. He built his own darkroom in the house. So I remember being in the darkroom with him as he's developing the photos. He's got these big photo paper, and he would hang them on a clip, and we would just wait and watch until the image appeared. And I love that smell, and I love just watching what we could do with a camera.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing your photos.
Well, thank you. All right. Well, stick with us, and we'll be back with Sherwin Bitsui on Words on a Wire. Sherwin Bitsui holds a BA from University of Arizona and an AFA in creative writing from the Institute of American Indian Arts. He is the recipient of a Truman Capote Creative Writing Fellowship, an individual poet grant from the Witter Beiner Foundation for Poetry, a Lannan Foundation Marfa Residency, a 2006 Whiting Writers Award, a 2008 Tucson MoCA Local Genius Award, a 2010 Penn Open Book Award, and an American Book Award for his book, Flood Song. Sherwin has published his poems in American Poet, the Iowa Review. His poems were also anthologized in Between Water and Song, Legitimate Dancers, American Poets of the New Century. He is the author of Shapeshift, University of Arizona Press, and his latest book, Flood Song by Copper Canyon. Sure, and welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me.
I have in my hand a copy of Flood Song, which I can't describe as reading it. I don't think I read it as much as I experienced it. I fell into it and couldn't get out. The language just pulled me from the beginning to the end with all these images popping out and all this electrical charge. It was just an incredible book. But it has an image on the front of it. It actually looks like a representation of what the book is like. There's images that are emerging. It looks like it's a watercolor, but it's almost like a mosaic. And I understand you painted this.
Yeah, the front cover is an acrylic painting that I created in 1999, and I call the painting Drought. And it was the most representative of my book. It felt, certainly, it was related to my book. So, but, you know, my book's called Flood Song, and the painting's called Drought.
Also, yeah, that opposition actually adds tension to the book, huh?
Yeah. Before Drought, and then afterwards is flooding. And I think... Shapeshift, my first book, has a lot of drought in it. There's a lot of searching for water. And I realized in my book, Shapeshift, that everything that contained water is somehow contaminated.
It also works on another level. Your book starts with a drip and ends with a flood. And here you start, the very first image is a drought, drip, and flood.
Yeah. The first poem is Toi, and it's a concrete poem, and the word Toi is our word for water. Mm. And it also sounds like a water dripping, and I was imagining it dripping in a canyon spring, in Sandstone Canyon Spring or somewhere like that. And, you know, repeated over and over again, it becomes dripping water. So it's called Toi, Toi, Toi.
You know, you say your first poem in the book.
Mm-hmm. I didn't
read it as individual poems. I read it as the book is a long poem. How I read it. I thought you were inviting me to read it that way.
Yes.
Not that it can't be broken down into sections, because of course they are. The way that you lay them out on the page, obviously you want us to stop. You want us to look at this section and stop there and then go on. Almost as if it was a TV show, okay, this was this week's segment of the show and then we move on. I was wondering, how did you conceive of the book when you started this? Was it organic? Did you just go with it? Did you plan it? Tell me about your process in this book.
Well, it began over 5 years ago. I had finished writing Shapeshift, and then I think my process is very intuitive. I catch glimmers of a poem that is forthcoming, and I follow it. And a lot of times I wait it out. And at the time, probably in 2005 or so, I knew I was, and this gets a little crazy, but I knew that I was receiving a poem, and I don't know if other poets feel this way, but I felt like I was gaining access to a poem that I was to write. And it was a very intuitive feeling. And I sort of sat back and I waited for the poem to arrive. And over the course of the next several years, this poem evolved. And it came in different incarnations, but I followed it in certain moments, in certain months of my process. Certain images kept coming through. And I think when I was in Marfa, Texas, for my London residency, I laid out all these fragments of the poem that I was writing, and I laid them out on this long table in my house that I was a resident of. And I saw that the poem actually took the shape of rushing water in a very horizontal way. Also, there was a lot of water images in there. The waters of my clans flash flooded. And then there were also figures in the work that were running from a type of flood. And even television snow, even this idea of television snow was a type of blizzard in one part of the piece. So over time, it was very confusing. I mean, it wasn't easy because I didn't know of any other poem written like it. So I was writing in the dark for the most part. I was writing inside a cloud and really not finding something to connect to, but some other book or some other poet to connect to. So I just started following these poems and the songs that they were singing and the way they were composing themselves in my mind as the writer or as the poet. And there's a lot of call and response in the work also. I mean, I read pieces of the poem to different audiences around the country when I was touring with Shapeshift. And I would say, I've got some new work, and I would read it, and I would read it out to the audience, and they would respond in a very positive way. So I knew that, yeah, the poem is very different, and the language is working very differently, but there is a response to it, and people find it, they connect to it. So I was very happy with that.
When you use the kind of process that you're talking about, that it's received, but even then, when the poem is received, the act of writing is not a passive art. So I'm wondering, how do you edit your work in a book like this?
I heard it. Over the manuscript, I would listen to it. I would give the poem or sections of the manuscript to people around me, and I would have them read it to me. And sometimes during lunch or on a long drive back to the res in northern Arizona from Tucson, certain people sang my poem back to me. Or sometimes I would even have it played back on the computer, on the MacBook. Because I felt like the poem comes alive during the reading of it. It's alive on the book, but I feel like it was really needed to be conveyed orally, or audibly, I guess. And that aspect of it was really important to me, because it is a song. Ultimately,
we're talking to Sherwin Bitsui, who is the author of Flood Song, a book of poems, or a book with a poem, depending on how you want to enter into it. I love what you're saying about receiving a poem, and it reminds me of how some poets believe that before the poem is a big stone, and they just chip away until they find it. But with you, it seems more to make more sense to receive it, because as I read this, I think to myself, how could any human being think of these things? It's just amazing, this flood of images and sound. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to read just an excerpt or a poem or a section from Flood Song so we can get a taste of what's going on.
Okay, this is I think it's on page 29, and it's a piece that I wrote when I was in the middle of the poem. The speaker of the poem actually speaks to being in that space. There is no sign of a trail leading out, only a pond of mule blood at the basin of the dam resting between us. Together we climb the song's hair, step onto the plank, and hear birth cries erupt into a bridge of starlight, connecting the ink-soaked shores of our nameless bodies to anchors of swans coughing dune sand onto a dry riverbed, lifting the cloth to smear the reed invisible. I notice spiders emerging where our hair slipped out and leap by firelight into the raft scribbled on pond water, its translucent oars chiming metallic as it sinks below sea level. The aching inserted sideways underneath the linoleum floor begins to sound less like weeping and more like the cawing of crows gathering thirsty, fat-bellied, outside the keyhole, for whom we have become bodies for the first time, for whom our language stabs the fork with a spoon.
Thank you. That was Sherwin Bitsui reading from Flood Song. I love the way you read. Sounds
right.
Like, you sound like a priest, man.
Well, you can tell, you listened. I know that my process is not at all like yours. We do have one thing in common, though. I have to read a poem out loud and hear it for myself.
Yeah.
And then I know what I need to take out, or then I know that it's finished, or then I know that I have to change some words because it just doesn't fit the rhythms that I want to be there. So I understand that aural quality of poetry, which some people call lyricism. And of course, your work is incredibly lyrical and careful. And your images are interesting because, you know, they're kind of opposite of something that I do. You know, I was taught in an old school by Denise Levertov, who says that if an image isn't literally true, then it can't work on a metaphoric level. You don't – that's that is not at all a kind of dictum that you follow.
No, no. I think I always wanted to create an image and make it real. Like quite oppositely, and it's very free imagination that guides my work, and that desire for freedom is really the impetus for the work. It needs to bleed out, and speaking on many levels and making that kind of work valid for my experience. You know, they are crazy images, aren't they?
You know, I imagine that if you are truly receiving poems, and I like the language that you just wait for it and you receive it, and it implies in part that you're, as a writer, almost a vessel or a conduit of this poem as it manifests itself onto the paper. And one of the struggles in receiving the poem, I would imagine, would be getting out of the way of the poem, letting our egos get out of the way, which is very difficult. And I'm wondering how you negotiate with that process, especially if you've been recognized so largely by the poetry community. Do you struggle with that at all?
No, because I think I've been given space to do what I do, and I trust the work, and I always want to have good work. I push myself, and like many poets out there, I think we're our worst critics. Right. So we desire to create work that stands and remains, or that makes people, I feel like if people are going to buy my book or then come to my reading, I want them to take back something. I don't want them to just, they've got it so ephemeral, and they forget immediately what happened. So I nurture that. But yeah, I guess there's some pressure about sometimes with poets, but I think most people realize that I work rather slowly.
Well, which brings us to the next question. What are you working on now?
I've got two strands. I've got the next book, I feel, is going to be very minimal. It begins after Flood Song. And it's how do I describe this? It doesn't have the flow that Flood Song had. Everything feels like a type of glottal stop. It feels like it pulses forth and it stops. So that's what I'm processing now. This notion of a moving image that suddenly is paralyzed by the camera or photographed, and it remains. Probably commentary, something going on in my life, or just in general, the politics of my being. Certainly a lot of commentary there, but that's the energy of the work. Yeah. And then it moves into more narrative pieces. And I don't want to really describe all that I'm doing, but these are the two areas that I'm working in now. And we'll see what happens, because, I mean, usually the first glimpse into these things, it really is not what I end up with. When I was writing Flood Song, I was saying, oh, I want to, because I was going to school at the time, at the University of Arizona, and everything, like, I'm loaded with politics already as a Native American, as a Navajo person. So I was like, okay, always this sort of expectation to be spiritual or to or somehow represent an entire continental culture, indigeneity or whatever. I mean, there's always those pressures. And I was like, okay, well, what if I made a statement in the way that I created a wholly irrelevant work, that I could create this empty book? But then, so that was my, you know, when I was writing that book, I was like, okay, let me write towards that emptiness. Let me write towards this dark matter. Mm. And then it flipped on me, and it became this other piece. You know, it became something that spoke in a very different way. And throughout the writing of the book, I realized a humanity and a borderless space, a beautiful space. Mm. So it was very cathartic for me on that level as well. So I enter my books somehow posing a question to myself, and then I write into it, and I write past it. Then I come back to the original question, and I realize that somehow the body, the work somehow transformed even the air around it. And I can smell new things, or I can taste new things, or I can see new things, or I can see old things in a new way. So there's that relationship I have with my work, and I think Flood Song certainly did that. And in hindsight, I read Flood Song now, and there's a certain kind of tension going on throughout the whole book that the book also feels like a type of fever dream.
Yes.
It's really interesting that way.
But in that way, one of the things that I really admire about Flood Song is that you really have succeeded in creating a borderless book.
Yeah, I feel it. I feel that that's what the book wanted to do, and that's what the poem wanted to do, and it wants to move between all of these spaces and not make huge distinctions between them, but they are an experience. It is an experience. And I think Daniel said that earlier. It felt like this huge experience, you know, and you're taken and then you're dropped off at the end with the image of the speaker choosing the first tree to chop down.
You have this line that about a leopard, the narrator, the speaker says, "I pull electricity from their softened bellies." And this image can't really be described. I don't think there's an intellectual understanding, but there's a deeper. There's something deeper. There's something in the gut that makes me understand exactly what you mean on a non-intellectual level, but a gut level.
Yeah, it's all gut. Leopard spots, ripe for drilling, ooze white gas when hung on a copper wire. There's all these sensations happening, yeah. Colors and moments of... And also blurs. I think there's a lot of blurs in the work as well. When I read them or when I have it read back to me, I realize, wow, they're blurs. And I was like, how did that happen, you know? Mirrors.
And do you think, because it seems to me that you also are so influenced by the landscape. You talk about drought and the flood, you know, when we get those rainstorms that are literally a flood in the drought of the desert. And though Albuquerque is also a desert, it's a very different landscape. Do you think that that's really going to affect your work, or do you feel that it's affecting your work?
Yeah, I mean, Flood Song was written in Tucson, and also... It also finds its home in northern Arizona on the Navajo Reservation, which is a high desert, very different desert. All these deserts are very different. To somebody from the East Coast or from the South, might say that it looks all the same, but, you know, those of us who live in the desert know they're very different. And I think that the landscape here is very similar to the landscape I grew up in. So... It feels like a type of coming home. And I did spend a lot of summers in Albuquerque. I have a lot of family here. Definitely what I'm vibing on here in New Mexico is a return to experience, a return to just my tongue, my language, and relationships with family and place. And it feels like a homecoming in a way.
You referred earlier to this, but I want to go into this a little bit more. This is Shirwin Bitsui, author of Flood Song. Your website says that Shirwin Bitsui is at the forefront of a new generation of Native writers who resist being identified solely by race. I have two questions. Number one, who are the other writers that are coming out that might be in your new tradition? And also, the word resist specifically implies that there's some sort of pressure from the... if we can call it the poetry industry, for Native Americans to write a certain way and to write about certain things. And how do you negotiate that?
There is a really exciting, this is an exciting time. Certainly there's a lot of emerging Native voices that are emerging into the poetry world, I guess, with books. And several poets that I know offhand are Santee Frazier. He's a Cherokee poet, author of Dark 30, Orlando White, a Navajo poet, Natalie Diaz just released a book called When My Brother Was an Aztec, a really amazing Mojave poet, and many, many others. And I could just list them and we could talk about them. You know. But it is an exciting time because I don't know if we're resisting. I don't know if that's the word to use. I think we've been influenced. We move about in the world, and we can't deny that we have all of these influences. that we converse with the present. We're not isolated as much anymore. So we're just following the tradition of every poet in every generation, and weaving, bringing new sensations into the work and maintaining story and keeping the fire alive.
Well, keep that fire alive.
Keep it on.
Thank you so much for being on our show, Sherwin. We really enjoyed our conversation.
And I can't wait to read your next book. Do you have a title yet?
No. I kind of do, but I'll keep it a secret for a little longer. It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed talking to you, too.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
And thank you, Sherwin Bitsui, for reading a poem and talking to us about your poetry. It's fantastic. Don't forget, follow us on iTunes, Facebook. We are looking for writers who want to do poetic license. These are 5-minute segments where we turn over the microphone to you to say whatever you want about poetry, about government, about consumerism, anything you want.
Calling all writers, calling all writers.
Just email me at danchacon@utep.edu or
bsigns@utep.edu.
And thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out my photo challenge on soychacon.blogspot.com.
And again, thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
And don't forget,
the next book you read
could save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubber-necked giraffe, you look into my past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right? Well, the altitude seems to get to me. I'm up on a tight wire, flanked by life and the funeral pyre. Putting on a show for you to see. Past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right? Well, the altitude really gets to me. I'm up on a tight wire.